From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a beautiful island community, a town called Sea Haven. Every year, Sea Haven is voted number one place to live in the world. The weather is perfect. The people are wonderful. And it's all fake. Well, all of it is fake except for one thing, one person, a man named Truman Burbank. Truman was literally born on camera, and unbeknownst to him, his entire life of 30 years has been a reality TV show called The Truman Show. The island community is part of a giant dome, the world's largest television set. His wife is an actor. His best friend is an actor. Everyone in his life is an actor. His own mother. He has not figured this out yet, but he is starting to feel like something is off. That is the premise of a film that is now a quarter century old. When The Truman Show was released in the late 1990s, reality TV was still in its infancy. MTV's Real World was a thing, but The Truman Show was written before even Survivor came on the scene. And while it starred Jim Carrey, the movie is not a comedy. It is a warning of sorts about consent, about privacy, about ubiquitous supervision, about what we will commodify for the purpose of entertainment. In Megan Garber's piece titled The Real Lesson of The Truman Show, she writes, quote, "The film predicted how we would settle into the muted voyeurism of this moment. It presaged the immense popularity of true crime, a genre that treats murder as a puzzle to be solved, abuses as stories waiting to be spun. It anticipated how readily we would come to see people as characters, the ease with which we would treat their lives as our entertainment," end quote. Garber goes on to say that of the film's many villains, the viewers of the show are at the top of the list. They are complicit, she writes, in trapping a human being against his will. Some of the viewers are even placing bets on whether he will survive an effort to leave Sea Haven. Have we learned anything? I watched The Truman Show this week, and I found it to be pretty chilling, and honestly, one of the best films I can remember watching recently. And yet, one of the breakout hits of the past year was a reality show called Jury Duty, in which an entire court case is fake. The courtroom is fake. The police are fake. The judge is fake. The entire jury is fake. Except for one man, one true man, who thinks he was brought to serve his civic duty. And the show documents his reactions to absurd situations and ultimately does bring him in on the joke. It works, at least from what I've seen, because the one true man, the Truman of jury duty, a man named Ronald, is a great dude. He's obviously kind and generous, and he always seems to be choosing the moral path. And that adds a sweetness to the show that could have been dark. I've enjoyed the episodes I've seen because the comedy is so quick. And yet I don't know if I can feel good about watching it because it seems we're just conditioning ourselves to laugh at the idea of consent or transparency or surveillance or privacy. Maybe you have a different view. Maybe I'm taking The Truman Show and Jury Duty too seriously. Maybe I should enjoy having cameras everywhere. And I should just say yes to whatever Mark Zuckerberg and Target and Starbucks want me to give up. Or maybe not. And our guests today are going to fight me about it. Now, we're going to have a good conversation. And we've got Linda Moroney with us, Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, programmer, educator. Great having you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Great to be here again.
Also with us is Matt Passantino, film critic for City Magazine. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Todd Sedano, Dr. Sedano, I presume, is Dr. Sedano.
It is. Todd's fine.
Todd's okay. All right, Dr. Todd, Associate Professor of Television History, Writing, and Production at St. John Fisher University. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
So I rewatched The Truman Show this week. When's the last time you've seen it, Matt Passantino?
Last night.
Last night. Linda?
I rewatched it last night as well.
Okay. And Todd?
Yesterday. I mean, two of us are educators, so we had to do our homework.
I mean, we're all fresh on The Truman Show.
Yeah.
We're going to talk Truman Show. We're going to talk Jury Duty. We're going to talk, this question of putting someone on camera without their consent and when that's okay or where are the lines, because the film hit me in a way that I didn't expect going back and watching. I knew that I liked it. I knew that I thought it was smart. But I went back and I thought, oh my gosh, it was written 30 years ago, really before. I mean, maybe The Real World was out, but pretty much it was prescient, I thought. And so, I mean, but I'm not a film critic, Matt Passantino. You are. What did you make of it when you went back and watched it?
Kind of what you said, just how kind of heartbreaking it is. I mean, you expect a Jim Carrey movie to be funny. And I mean, it's funny along the way. It's almost like a tragic comedy because Jim Carrey can't help but to bring his persona to it. But this is a dialed down Jim Carrey. This is a this is not Ace Ventura, Jim Carrey.
No.
And he conveys like the naivete of his situation so well that kind of transforms into the heartbreak of the reality, because it's the Truman Show is a reality show.
So it's kind of a tragic comedy.
Tragic comedy.
Linda, what did you make going back and watching it?
Well, I think I would start with saying that here's a piece of art that was created 25 years ago, and we're looking at it again. And how effective of a piece of art is that? That it's still topical, that we're still seeing new dimensions and new levels that maybe we didn't see when we first watched it 25 years ago or 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, right? That it still has something to say to us in this moment. So, I mean, that's really effective art. How many films from 25 years ago that we're not talking about anymore and we've just sort of tossed to the bin or aside? So I think that's really, really effective. And having this conversation and other people, I'm sure, are as well 25 years later, I think that's incredibly effective. I think it's really a powerful film, and I think it still has a lot to say. You know, watching it last night, I'm sure everyone has seen it by now. That's probably listening to give everything away and not to give everything away.
I think we can spoil. I think you can spoil.
But I was thinking about what happens after, like when Truman walks out the door. Like, I wanted to know when he re-enters the real world.
Or enters it for the first
time. Right.
Yeah.
And everyone in the world knows who he is, knows everything about him. And he is there himself trying to make sense of this, right? And feeling isolated, I'm sure, at that point, not understanding and trying to make sense of everything. So I was really, really thinking about that and where it goes next.
I can't believe they didn't make a sequel. Everybody makes sequels these days. Hollywood's addicted to sequels. The Truman in the Real World. I don't know. Maybe they still will, Linda. I don't know if I want that now, but I was wondering the same thing. Yeah. Todd, what did you make of it?
I was thinking, why didn't they make a sequel? And I'm glad they didn't, right?
You're glad they didn't. Okay.
I mean, in that period of time, if we're looking at movies in the mid-1990s, late-1990s, there was some kind of experimentation going on. There was a lot of action movies, a lot of popcorn films, Speed, The Fugitive. We started to get more experimental with people like Quentin Tarantino emerging on the scene. I mean, we had the forgettable Speed 2, which is, I think, coming up on Connections next week. No, I don't think so.
I don't know if that one calls for it.
But there's something about this film that, and I don't want to be too pedantic, but I don't think we can call it a tragic comedy if he doesn't die at the end. Walking out that door, I think, gives us some hope. And I like Linda's thought, which is what happens next. Because the only person who seems upset by it is the producer, right? That seems to be Christoph, Ed Harris's character, which by today's standards, I'm not sure that would be the story. There's something about that that seems a little uplifting for our main guy, for Truman.
Elaborate on that point. I mean, what would be different today?
Maybe it's not just today. Can I make another connection?
Yeah, yeah.
You use the word prescient to describe the film. I was thinking more about Network.
Mm-hmm.
From 50 years ago, Paddy Chayefsky's film, which really sort of augured where we were going in American television culture.
Mm-hmm.
And you have people watching this guy kill himself on stage. And then ultimately he's shot. He's assassinated on stage. And everybody claps, roll credits. It seems like this was a softer landing for this kind of a movie, which surprised me, considering I think Network is a fair predecessor for Truman Show.
Yeah, and certainly there's echoes of Network in Joker with Joaquin Phoenix as Joker. But, you know, what I know now about Truman Show, having done a lot of reading this week, is they initially thought about having it set in New York City. It was gritty. You know, Truman witnesses a violent crime. Unbeknownst to him, he's on a reality show. He doesn't know if he wants to report it. It becomes like this kind of darker look at human nature. And the writers and directors got together and was like, no, we're going to kind of change some of the calculus here, because the point they were wanting to make, they felt like they needed their own space, their own fictional space, and not put it in New York City. And I would have been curious to see what that would have looked like. It would have been darker. But this film's still kind of dark to me. In fact, we're going to play a clip in a minute that, I mean, I thought Ed Harris is masterfully dark in this, isn't he?
Yeah, he's the only actor who earned an Academy Award nomination for it, and he barely appears for the first hour of the film.
I have so much to say about the Oscar aspect.
Oh, okay.
I'll leave it to Matt. Go ahead.
He almost won the Academy Award for it. And it's just, and it kind of shows you the footprint this movie has, is that people still talk about how it's crazy that Jim Carrey didn't get nominated for this, because he kind of lives in that Adam Sandler air of they'll never take him seriously as a serious actor. And he's been good in movies like The Truman Show and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Because it was just Ed Harris who was representing the movie at the Oscars.
Harris didn't win. He was nominated. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, he didn't win.
I don't know. It seems like a pretty good... Well, let's listen to some of Ed Harris. So Ed Harris plays Kristoff. All we know is he's Kristoff. He's essentially the man behind the show from the beginning. He is maybe our guest will talk about this a little bit more, but to me, rewatching it, he's kind of a God figure. He thinks of himself as a God figure. He's literally in the moon when they interview him, because Truman doesn't realize that the moon he's seeing in the sky is a physical set, and that's where the director and the crew is. And so what you're going to hear is a very familiar voice to you, especially from the 1990s, Harry Shearer. He's playing a talk show host, True Talk, and he's talking to Kristoff, creator of The Truman Show. And Kristoff is talking about how Truman was born on camera and how this all came to be and why he doesn't leave. Let's listen.
He was curious from birth. He was premature by 2 weeks. It was almost as if he couldn't wait to get started.
And of course, his eagerness to leave his mother's womb was the very reason he was the one who was elected.
In competition with 5 other unwanted pregnancies, the casting of a show determined by an air date, Truman was the one who arrived on cue.
Incidentally, I believe Truman is the first child to have been legally adopted by a corporation.
That's correct.
The show has generated enormous revenues, now equivalent to the gross national product of a small country.
People forget it takes the population of an entire country to keep the show running.
Mm-hmm. Since the show is on 24 hours a day without commercial interruption, all those staggering revenues are generated by product placement.
That's true. Everything on the show is for sale, from the actors' wardrobe, food products, to the very homes they live in.
And, of course, all of it available in the Truman catalog, and operators are standing by. Kristoff, let me ask you. Why do you think that Truman has never come close to discovering the true nature of his world until now?
We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
That last line, we accept. Now, the scary thing to me is that last line could spark sort of a new breed of conspiracy theorists. You know, like, nothing is real. I knew it. I'm in the Truman Show. But it's powerful, isn't it, Matt? I mean, Ed Harris is phenomenal in this.
He's so good in this. And it's, the movie doesn't necessarily go out of its way to try to side with Ed Harris' character, because he's the puppet master throughout this.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely one of the villains.
He's the villain of the movie. But it almost listening to that clip again and watching last night, I was like, you almost wonder, is some guilt coming out of him in that line, because, he says he was born curious. He's just making that up. It's because he needs a justification for what he's doing to Truman. And so I'm just wondering, is he trying to justify his actions? Does he feel guilty? I think it's a really interesting character for being the villain of the movie.
Well, yeah. And I saw Linda nodding when I said, to me, he was like a godlike character. There's at one point, he later in that scene, he says, if he truly wanted to leave, we couldn't stop him. Well, it turns out when Truman does try to leave, Ed Harris's character is willing to kill him as opposed to let him leave, with weather, controlling weather and wind and water, to literally kill him on live television broadcast to 1.5 billion people. That's a godlike complex, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's referred to as the creator, right? Not the director, not the producer. He is the creator. That's how they refer to him. So I think that is completely there in the text.
Why didn't I think of that? That's why you're here.
That's why we're all here. But I think also, you know, power doesn't concede, right? And we know that. I mean, we can look at this in another way. And also the idea that he's, Truman is a commodity, right? He belongs to a corporation. And as we know through laws, corporations are people, right? We have those laws. So that's where we are now, which is crazy. But I think that idea that he sees Truman as this commodity, and I don't know. I think he is... He knows better, like he's not unknowing of what he's doing. I think it is very complicated, like you said, Matt, but I think he thinks he is benevolent in his mind of he knows best. It's that sort of mentality of he's going to do what's best for everything.
For sure. It's either that he truly believes it or he has to keep saying it to justify in his mind. Because when one of the former cast members who tried to tell him the truth calls that show, Christoph, the creator, tells her, you know, well, you're just upset because you know the reality is that Truman's got a better life in here than he would out there, that I've given him this great life and that he's happier here than he could ever be in your screwed up real world. I don't know if you believe that, but you might say it to justify your horrible actions, right? Maybe you do believe it. Maybe he does believe it. So that's the story of the creator. You want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. A couple of things. Well, the old George Costanza line, it's not a lie if you believe it. That definitely affects Christoph
here. George Costanza is correct about everything. That's right.
The second thing, more seriously, though, I think the context that we examine the fictional Truman Show or the non-fictional Truman Show in the universe of the Truman Show movie requires some examination. If you're talking about 1.5 billion people watching it, there's people watching it in the movie in their bathtubs, on the couch, in restaurants.
In bars, yeah.
In bars, right? That wouldn't happen today that I would think they would get that many people invested or interested. We've become so fragmented,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We're talking about jury duty here before the show, and some of us have seen all of it.
He means the reality TV show, in case you're just joining us. He doesn't mean actual jury duty. Go ahead.
Which kind of makes my point,
yeah,
right?
Right.
I mean, we used to feed from the same cultural trough as everyone else, and we knew exactly what people were watching and how they were watching it. Now these references just are obscure, and I used to feel terrible if I hadn't heard of a show or hadn't seen a movie. Now it's, okay, I won't get around to it, but thank you for the recommendation. This is different. If this were made today, I don't think you would have that many people tuning in at the exact same moment on television sets. It would be on screens. It would probably go with a whisper, not a bang,
Or people would share clips later, but they're not watching it as appointment viewing.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing contemporaneous about that. You're right.
And I actually think that lack of a shared experience is kind of a bummer. I don't know that there's any getting around that anymore with the fragmentation of media, but...
There is.
Huh?
Matt and I talked in the green room beforehand, and he's like, people should go to the movies. Those are those shared experiences.
Yes, they should. That is a shared experience, right?
It's what streaming can't provide. And so that's, you know, you're talking about feeling like you can't miss out. And the most recent example is, you know, we've talked about it for almost a year now, Barbenheimer. I mean, everyone felt like they had to be there to witness something or they were missing out. And I mean, it's like you're saying, it's just so rare now that there is no such thing as an appointment viewing anymore. So it's really has to take off where, you know, the Truman Show has got the entire world wrapped around its finger.
Yeah. And I think there was Linda Holmes from NPR a number of years ago was writing about the full drop or the binge drops that Netflix has cornered the market on, dropping all their episodes at once. And Hulu's doing this with The Bear in a couple of weeks, where she said that everything is a spoiler and nothing is a spoiler on that day because everyone has it at the same time. You can't spoil it for everyone because every single episode is there for you. By the same token, because we're all on different schedules and nothing is appointment, at that point, everything is a spoiler until we find out how many of you have actually watched every episode of Jury Duty, for instance.
Great point. Linda, I want to ask you a little bit more about this, the power that a creator or a director would have. I mean, in other interviews I've seen, Ed Harris has said that, you know, Christoph viewed himself as a benevolent documentarian, just sharing the story with the world. He's not a documentarian, is he?
Oh, no, I would say no. Ethically,
he's a manipulator.
No.
He's a manipulator.
Yeah,
right?
No, he's crossed many ethical issues in that making of that TV show. You know, I think talking about documentaries here for a second, that for a long time, you know, since the 60s, for 20, 30 years, there was this movement called about observational filmmaking, right? And the idea was that you'd shoot and shoot and shoot. Your shooting ratio would be so massive. You'd have cameras around all the time. There'd be small crews so that the people that you're filming would forget that you're there, right? Because you're there all the time. And then the filmmaker could get to those realistic moments of real, honest truth. And the last 10 years or so, filmmakers are like, you know what? That's never, ever going to happen. That's a complete farce. As soon as there's a camera there, you know, people are, you're never going
to
get there.
I want your take on this. That's exactly what I wanted to talk about. Can you get something, quote unquote, genuine if you know there's a camera on you?
You know, it's hard to say what it is and the people, and like there's many, many factors that go into that. But what I was going down the path to say is that there's been this pushback now of really saying there's a camera there and we should lean into the performance aspect of having a camera in the room. So there's been a lot more films that have been reworking, and this is going to sound horrible, reenactments into documentaries in a way that actually gives subjects, which we now actually call participants, we don't really call them subjects anymore, agency over their own stories. So there was a film that came out last year called Four Daughters. It was a Tunisian film, absolutely beautiful, about a woman who had four daughters. Two of them are not there. So the director hired two other women to play the older daughters and hired a woman to play the mother when things got too emotional. And so you actually see moments where the real mother is explaining how things and scenes would have gone and what the differences were. And in these moments where the director and the mother or one of the daughters are talking, there's these moments of truth that you would not have gotten to on like a formal interview or an informal interview or observationally shooting. So there's these moments, these pockets that are just absolutely amazing and sort of these universal but very personal truths that are phenomenal. So this new blending, which has happened for many, many years, but revisiting it and doing it in a way that participants have agencies over their own stories is really in vogue in documentary filmmaking at the moment.
I mean, I'd have to really kind of sit with that and see more of it and think about it to kind of get to really shape an opinion about how I feel about it. I kind of feel a little strange about it. Mm. I can think it could be powerful. But what you're describing as uncovering truths is a better word, insights, as opposed to truth. Truths is a word that seems to carry a lot of sort of finality.
Yeah, but there could be personal truths, right? It could be honest moments. I think there's different ways of saying
valuable
that,
perspective.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it sounds
like... And so it doesn't work for every subject, every topic, but for some films, especially films that deal with trauma and things like that, it has been really, really invaluable and seeing things in a new way. So there's this whole movement happening right now.
We're talking about a quarter century since The Truman Show came out. And, you know, in the last year, there's been a lot written about what we learned or didn't learn and not just reality TV, but sort of the constant camera culture, the constant on-camera culture, consent, privacy, transparency. And we're talking about that with Linda Moroney, who is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, programmer, educator, Matt Pasentino, film critic for City Magazine, Todd Sedano, associate professor of television history, writing, and production at St. John Fisher University. And I've got one more clip I'd like to share from The Truman Show. It's a longer clip, but... this to me is the core of how gross everything feels. The clip you're about to hear is the scene in which Truman really feels like he's losing it. Like he knows something is off. A light has fallen from the sky. Literally a what kind of light is that? What was the light? Film people. What was
a Klieg?
A Klieg light? Is that
maybe
a Klieg light? What other lights are there, Todd? It's a Klieg.
Fresnel.
Oh, okay.
I think it was a Fresnel.
Okay. Oh, so it's a light from the sky, and there's actually a deleted scene. I know this because I've done a lot of reading. There's a deleted scene in which his best friend tells him that he read on the news that it was that it fell out of an airplane, and he tells Truman, "You're just unlucky it didn't hit you. You could have sued." And Truman keeps it, and he's like, "You really think this could have come out of an airplane?" I mean, he's starting to kind of piece it together. He's seeing people act strange. He thinks he sees his father, who the show wrote out of his life because the actor who played his father was not only a pain, but they wanted to make Truman scared to travel So they had them out in a boat together, and his father dies at sea, which is just like, ugh. But anyway, Truman is putting it together, and he's losing it. And he's sitting at the end of a pier with his best friend since childhood, Marlon, again, an actor, someone who spent years acting as someone's best friend. And you're going to hear their conversation. You're going to hear Christoph come into it because he's feeding lines to Marlon, the creator. And there's one line in particular here that I'm going to key in on when we're done here to talk about how truly icky all of this feels. This is from The Truman Show.
I don't know what to think, Marlon. Maybe I'm losing my mind, but it feels like the whole world revolves around me somehow.
It's a lot of world for one man, Truman. Sure, that's not wishful thinking? You wishing you'd made something more out of yourself? Come on, Truman. Who hasn't sat in the John, had an imaginary interview on Sea Haven tonight? Who hasn't wanted to be somebody?
This is different. Everybody seems to be in on it.
I've been your best friend since we were 7 years old, Truman. The only way you and I ever made it through school was by cheating off each other's test papers. Jesus. They were identical. But I always felt safe knowing that. Because whatever the answer was, we were right together and we were wrong together. Remember that time I stayed up with you all night in your tent? Because you wanted to play North Pole? And I got pneumonia? You remember that?
You were out of school for about a month.
You're the closest thing I ever had to a brother, Truman. I know that things haven't really worked out for either of us like we used to dream they would. I know that feeling when it's like everything's slipping away and you don't want to believe it, so you look for answers somewhere else, but
point is, I'd gladly walk in front of traffic for you.
Well, the point is, I would gladly step in front of traffic for you, Truman.
And the last thing I'd ever do is lie to you.
And the last thing that I would ever do is lie to you. I mean, think about it, Truman. If everybody is in on it, I'd have to be in on it, too. Oh. I'm not in on it, Truman, because there is no it.
Oh, of course there wasn't it. And yet, there's two things about this scene that grossed me out the most, and it's not going to be necessarily what people think. You end up seeing all of the viewers in different places, in bathtubs, in bars, on the edge of their seat, and they're crying and they're watching. And they know that this guy is having his best friend lie through his teeth to him just to keep him imprisoned on this television set. And I wonder, like, would I be that person? Like, it's so easy for me to be like, oh, that audience is gross. But like, then I'm like, is that me? Like, am I? That's awful. But then the other line was when they talked about how Marlon says he gets pneumonia. And Truman's like, you were out of school for a month. Truman doesn't know that that was just him taking a vacation as an actor to be in the real world where Truman is not allowed to go. But it's just something that they laugh about. And you could just so easily lie to somebody. For what? For a job. So that whole scene to me is easy to feel like gross about, but I also feel like it's a mirror and I'm like, what am I doing that promotes this kind of voyeurism, this kind of commodification. How much of that is me? That's how I took it, Todd.
Hearing that scene again, it's so powerful because they're having such a moment, the two of them.
That they think is very private?
That they think
is... that Truman thinks is very
private. Exactly, that he thinks is very private. And it's such a great move by either the screenwriter, Andrew Niccol, or Peter Weir, the director, for saying, here's when we insert that this is the creator. These are lines planted by Christoph, the creator slash executive producer slash storyteller. And then that's the punch in the stomach. Because you're watching the movie thinking, I'm so moved by this. And then, oh, that was all fabricated? All these lines that Marlon's delivering? This is, how gullible, how credulous am I? It's tough.
Yeah. What do you think, Linda Moroney?
Well, I think that's a point of great filmmaking in the sense we see Christoph very briefly in the beginning, but then we just go into the opening credits of The Truman Show, and we're in there for a while. And then we start seeing, oh, some other people watching, and we're, you know what I mean? They're not spoon-feeding us this early on. They're not introducing and setting up all the backstory early on. They're letting it go, letting us as an audience buy into it as well and see what we think, and then... you know, keep peeling things away, and you're like, oh, right, you know.
Mm. Matt?
Really keen in on that scene. It's just the you know, I mean, Truman's entire life has been manipulated, but the manipulation of that scene of someone he really, really trusts to call upon these childhood artificial memories to try and, but you know, listening to that clip, I really keyed on, I would have to be a part of it. I would have, I mean, just... It's almost shameless. It is shameless. And just to keep, he keeps twisting that. And it's just like, that's when you kind of see like the heartbreak of Truman Burbank kind of start to set in.
So when we come back from our only break, we're going to talk about other shows. And if we've learned any lessons, if we are just okay with giving up our privacy, if The Truman Show, if it was a real show, would it work today? I really want to believe it wouldn't. Our guests are going to tell me it wouldn't, I hope. But we're going to talk about shows like Jury Duty and other things that make me uncomfortable, and yet I'm like, I'm watching. Like I justify because I'm like, well, that guy found it, and he gave him $100,000, and he knew later. So, you know, let's come back in a moment, and we'll make me feel worse on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, we sit down with the president and CEO of the YMCA of Greater Rochester, Ernest Lemoore. Lemoore took over the top position in January of 2023. He talks with us about his vision for the nonprofit and its reach and impact in the Rochester area. In our second hour, who is responsible for patient safety? It's a question explored in an award-winning podcast called Imminent Danger, and the creator joins us. Dallas writes to say, when people say that we will end up having our lives constantly live-streamed, I feel like there's a push to guilt people into doing it, that if you're not, you should be. That's my sense of it. That's Dallas. Yeah, I mean, like, that's a good point, too. I didn't think about that, but everything is either live-streamed or live video, you know, Facebook Live or live-streamed somewhere. Yeah, Todd?
So had we not been discussing this today, I would not have noticed that for the listeners out there, we are currently in a room with at least 5 microphones, and by my count... 1, 2, 3, 4 cameras that I was not aware of the
that
other times I've been on the show that I can see. A couple of monitors, right? we're always being watched. And especially on the heels of watching The Truman Show, this is our world now, right? Foucault wrote about the panopticon and how we're always being watched, whether we're in a prison, an academic institution, and now on public radio, it seems like we are being watched and recorded, perhaps, and live streamed.
So, and the extension of that is this that I wanted to ask you, all of you about. Gia Tolentino wrote, I think, both a book and a really good piece for The New Yorker about the nature of performance and the way that we are always, in a sense, performing. So I always appreciate it when Connections listeners are like, boy, you sound like you do in real life as you do on the radio. And I'm like, I hope so. Or you seem like the same kind of person. I'm like, well, I hope so. But anytime you're on a microphone, you're in a sense, you're performing. That's what Gia is writing about. She's saying, if you are delivering evidence in a trial, like if you're a witness in a trial, you're performing. If you are giving a speech at a wedding, you're performing. Is that the real you? I hope so. But I mean, like, what what is the real you? And is the real you the one that's not performing, that's not on any camera, that's just having a private conversation or thinking you are? And do we ever stop performing? Do we lose ourselves? Or is that just the nature of the modern world where we feel like we're either always on camera or there's always some kind of ourselves? When you post on Facebook, you are performing. When you post on social media, you're performing. So it's like a constantly performative culture that she, Gia Tolentino, is worried kind of corrodes the idea of authenticity. What do you think?
I appreciate that. I think performative is a better way of describing it than real or unreal, truth or untruth. Anytime we get into binaries or black and white or real or not real, I think we've reduced it unfairly and inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. That's well said. Linda?
I would definitely agree with that. I mean, everything is curated, right? All of that social media that people do is all curated of how they want people to perceive themselves. So it is performative. I know myself, I do a lot less on social media
these days.
Yeah. You know, I'll post about the Teen Film Festival and films that I'm screening and stuff like that, but I do less, a lot less personal and stuff because it's just too much.
Is it draining?
It's draining. And also, you know, it doesn't matter what people think I had for breakfast, right? Does that matter? Or, you know, and I have kids, you know, so I don't want to be showing stuff with them. Who knows what it's going to be like 25 years from now.
And how much privacy
now.
They will
yeah,
want, right?
Exactly.
And how much consent they have or don't have right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so you're just saying that you've gotten wiser as social media has gotten older.
I hope so.
Matt?
I don't post much on social media. I just, anytime I have an opinion out of a movie, I think everyone else should hear it, but that's just, I guess that's just me. But I think watching Truman Show this time around was really to juxtapose it to like our reality craze culture now is, you know, people want to, you know, anyone with a TikTok account wants to be famous these days, and they put their entire, like, some things that you just scroll on, you know, I'm like, why would you put, like we talk about, like, don't you crave the privacy of your, of the situation? And I think that's the sadness of the Truman Show is that he, I mean, it's built, the movie's billed as just some ordinary guy. I mean, he didn't ask for this. He didn't, you know, he wasn't curious when he was born. You know, he didn't want to be a part of this I think in today's culture that is so heavily dominated by reality and social media, reality TV and social media, people crave that. And it's just kind of interesting to see that again and how it kind of almost destroyed Truman. So I think that's just kind of an interesting kind of putting it up against today's world.
Right. Now it's that cult of celebrity that everyone wants to put everything out there and stream live and
there's
be
so many,
influencers.
There's so many people that come up on like Twitter or Instagram, whatever, and it's like, so and so, I'm like, who? Like, why are they famous? And
it's just. I mean, it's something in this conversation is dawning on me, and this is a very partially formed thought, but forgive me, but listening to what you're talking about here, it seems to me that the irony is that the lesson was supposed to be very careful about this, and yet a quarter century after the Truman Show, there's a lot of people who want to be Truman, like who crave that, as opposed to the lessons against the commodification of everything that you do and the live streaming of every moment of your life and the lack of privacy. I mean, plenty of people want privacy, but plenty of people don't. Plenty of people want to be seen all the time. And that seems its own kind of malady.
And telling us what they had for breakfast,
and
to Linda's
exhausting.
Point.
Exhausting.
You guys really don't like breakfast, turns out.
I do. I just don't have to share it with y'all.
Well, building on Linda's point, this is Carly. She writes, if you haven't already covered this, can you talk about the implications of surveillance culture and the commodification of kids? I almost never post pictures of my kids, and when I do, their faces aren't showing. Even Zuckerberg doesn't reveal the faces of his children in posts anymore. The generation of kids who grew up being live streamed are now coming of age and reflecting on the invasive nature of parents posting without their permission. The psychological abuse of mommy bloggers is an extreme example here. That is from Carly. It's kind of what we were talking about there, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I definitely posted when they were younger. And
me too.
So excited. They did, you know, they had a home run at the game today or whatever it was. But it's, you know, been a long time. And, you know, a few years ago, I would just start asking them, is it okay if I post this or not, you know, to get their permission. But now I don't really post much at all.
I actually record quite a lot of like when he's playing baseball and stuff. I don't post any of it.
Yeah.
Like it's for him, it's for family, it's for us.
Yeah.
And it's for cool little things that we can do with it. But
same.
It's not like, yeah, my kid did this today. Which, again, if people are hearing me say that and you're sharing all the time, like, that's also a choice. I'm not, like, trying to condemn everybody else's choices that are different from mine. I'm just observing my discomfort with it.
And that goes back to Truman Show, right? He didn't have a choice.
He didn't have a choice.
So
that's right.
So if they grow up and they want to, you know, make films and stuff about themselves or whatever they want to do, that's different than not having that choice like Truman.
So can the three of you disabuse me of the discomfort I have? I'd like to keep watching Jury Duty. I'm really enjoying it. But I also feel like I am in the Truman Show audience here and I'm part of the problem. Like, I'm the villain here. The concept of Jury Duty, which is, what, about a year old now? I think it came out last year, The Sun Ran. It's a California courtroom. Everything in it is fake, except for one member of the jury who has gone through a whole selection process. He thinks everything is real. He thinks there's a real case that they are adjudicating. He thinks that the judge who's telling them at the beginning that he's been doing this for 38 years and he's retiring, this is his last case. He thinks the judge is real. The judge is not real. The judge in real life was a lawyer and is now an actor. He thinks everything about it is real. They get sequestered. He thinks his quirky, kind of like sweet mate is real, who is hilarious and very over the top weird. And yet the one guy who is real and doesn't know the rest of it's fake, the Truman of this show, is such a nice person from what I've seen. Like, I'm like, you can't, I'm wondering if he's real. Cause I'm like, there's nobody this genuinely gracious and generous and giving. So anyway, that's called Jury Duty. Todd, should I feel gross about liking it and should I stop?
No, excuse me. You should feel gross about watching it out of order, as apparently you did.
Yeah, I mean, watching a later episode because it was accidentally, I was accidentally thrust into the later part of the season first. I'm going to spoil a little, and if you really want to watch Jury Duty, I'm just going to tell you that it works out okay for the guy. Like, he's not angry the way Truman would be angry in the movie. This is a real life guy named Ronald. You know, they end up paying him $100,000 for doing it, and he's apparently doing great. He's like hanging out with Ryan Reynolds, and like everybody loves the guy. So it's like his best life. But there's no guarantee, Todd, that he was going to be happy with this.
Right, and this is when it fits into a kind of genre piece, right? And by genre, we mean some kind of type of TV show, some type of content that Truman fits into, that this fits into, that I think Network fits into to an extent. If we look at the rehearsal by the Nathan Fielder show from a couple of years ago or just last year, same kind of thing, where the conflict is you're waiting for that shoe to drop where the person who doesn't know what's happening, that this is all artifice.
Joe Schmo. It's amazing I know that one.
Okay.
But go ahead.
I'm imagining
I'm kind of embarrassed
something
that,
similar.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed
that you're waiting
that
for the audience to find out, or that the main person finds out that this is all artifice, this is all fake. And then once it happens, what's the aftermath look like? And I think the creators of Jury Duty have said, we didn't expect Ronald to be that good of a person, that nice. It would have been a different story we were telling if he turned out not to be.
They tweaked what was going on just to basically accommodate the fact that their star was just a wonderful dude who maybe wasn't going to act in certain ways that they expected. So they tweaked a little. That's crazy to me. That's wild. But I mean, like, I still feel like even if the guy's okay with it, even if he got his $100,000, he's getting his fame, he's going to end up just fine. He had to give up his time. They were sequestered. He had to give up his phone. He's giving up days of his life. He didn't have consent. Like, he didn't know there were cameras on him in most of these places. There was only a few places, the courtroom and these interview sessions, where he would have known. So he's being filmed surreptitiously. I don't want to normalize me thinking that it's cool as a viewer to. Like, that's the part that I feel like crosses a line for me.
Yeah, and part of me, I shouldn't speak for every viewer. Part of me felt icky watching early on,
okay.
And towards the very end, when that shoe drops and he finds out that this was all fake, I felt even ickier. But they land the plane, and you feel good about him. But the good part is, if you're interested in this stuff, you get to have a good conversation with the people around you about it.
Okay,
not unlike what this is, right?
I hope so. Linda, am I going to feel, I mean, like, disabuse me of this bad feeling?
You know, I think it works because of casting so well, right? And they had no idea how amazing and nice this guy was going to be. You know, if he had been a jerk, it would have felt more reality TV, that sort of competition stuff that is so prevalent. But I think, you know, when we watch these types of things, we sort of insert ourselves. And what if it was me, as you were talking about before? Would I make the same choices? Would I be that kind, right? Would I be thinking that along this way? So a lot of times is we're just putting ourselves in to see where we fit in this and how our lives line up to some degree as well. I don't think you should feel icky. I enjoyed it. I really love spaces between nonfiction and fiction. And I think this is also akin to more like those hidden camera prank shows, if you will. This is sort of an expansion of that, like yeah. Candid Camera. And, you know, I think it comes from
which I don't love
from there. Right.
But Linda, I honestly think I would have liked this more if I hadn't come right off the Truman Show. And I wasn't thinking about it in that context.
That's a good point. I think you need
space. I really do. So, Matt, you said you got through half the season.
Yeah.
You're the weirdo who reads half a book. You don't read like two chapters. And you're like, I'm not reading this book. You're like, I'm going to read 150 pages, and then I will stop.
If you only knew how many books.
Good for you, Matt. Time is too precious.
I'll close the book.
In hindsight, you're fine. He's going to the Emmys. He's having a good time.
He was compensated.
And it was a much shorter duration of time, right?
It wasn't 30 years from birth. Yeah, right. 30 years from birth.
Although he still has to go to jury duty next time he's called because
it was fake.
Yeah.
Right. Ed Harris is not speaking on his behalf as a child, so you're fine.
And the creators are not trying to kill him if he leaves the show.
Exactly. I'm one of those skeptical people. I want to know how much he really didn't know, but that's just me.
Like, part of me is like, this is so good. Like, how?
I know.
This feels a little pat here. Was that good?
Did you find, Evan, a connection, so to speak, when you're seeing Ed Harris feed the words to Marlin? Much in the way, perhaps, of your show, where a producer's feeding you feedback, a line, a question.
Yes, but I'm overt. Like, there's times where I'll say, hey, producer Megan Mack, can we check this out? And I will tell the audience, like, here's what she's telling me. The audience should know that the brains of this show is Megan Mack. I am literally the microphone of the show. That we, that Rob, Megan, the wonderful volunteers, the newsroom, it is definitely a team effort. But when someone's feeding me something, you know, I've been a news anchor before this life and had people feed stuff in my ear that I'm relaying. I don't view that as the same. So like if I'm reporting on something that's happening live, I think the audience knows I've got an earpiece and that I'm connected to producers who may tell me information that I can share. I try to be very transparent here about where it's coming from when I ask. The difference there is Marlin is playing a character who's got one of the most delicate moments of a human life happening, and all of it was fed into his ear to say, that's gross.
And since he was 7 years old.
And since he was seven.
He was there pretty much almost as long as Truman.
And then the creator of the show, Christoph, starts bragging that they still are on course for the first on-air conception.
Ugh. Yeah, that was a throwaway line, but that was icky.
There's another deleted scene where that comes up again. There's a couple deleted scenes that are really good that I'm surprised were deleted that you can find on YouTube. We've been talking about The Truman Show, and we've been talking about jury duty and surveillance culture and privacy. Dell, who is a defense attorney, says about jury duty, I love this show. He says, I think the difference, though, is that even though Ron did not realize he was being lied to, he did, in fact, sign up to be televised. The trick was not that he was being surveilled, which I think would be the big betrayal. He was already aware he would be televised going in. Okay. Not in the hotel room, Dell. Not in, the waiting room talking to other quote-unquote cast members, possible jurors. But
does Christoph have Dell on retainer?
Dell's nowhere near the level of deviousness of Christoph. Dell's a somewhat regular who's been on the show and does really good work down in Ontario County, and I appreciate that. But Dell, you got a little Christoph in you. You didn't know that until today. I guess we all do. That's kind of where I'm wrapping this. Like my brain is concluding this hour going, I'm much more okay with this than I think I want to be. And our kids' generations and their kids' generations are going to be, they're not even going to really have a concept of privacy. And I don't know how we get that
back. So
if I can make another recommendation, it's going to be in the 90s next week. So when people are not listening to public radio,
yeah, could be 100.
They should be watching some of these films, right? Can we talk about where they can stream something like Truman Show?
Got to do it fast. Yeah.
I think I did it on Paramount Plus. Was that right?
I don't remember. Yeah.
Netflix? I think Paramount Plus. 20 years before Network, there was a movie called A Face in the Crowd, which is a fantastic movie, also prescient. Bud Schulberg, who wrote On the Waterfront, Elia Kazan directed it, who directed On the Waterfront. And it stars this new guy who was new to cinema called Andy Griffith. And it was a few years before his show became popular in the 1960s. And it shows what happens when somebody just grabbed from the street is thrust into celebrity culture and it takes over. It is a dark, disturbing film and wonderful. And it raises the same questions, I think, as Network does, as Truman Show, as Jury Duty, as The Rehearsal, as some of these others that we've talked about here.
A Face in the Crowd?
A Face in the Crowd.
That's on your watch list. Anything on your watch list, Matt Pasentino?
So I was trying to think what I was Googling what other movies kind of are in the same vein of Truman Show, and I was getting some weird examples.
Yeah.
But I mean, I would catch up with the Truman Show. I mean, if you haven't seen it,
worth a watch.
It's
or rewatch.
A good movie, and it's obviously a very nuanced movie that we're having this discussion.
Yeah.
And I mean, I would catch up with the Truman Show. I mean, it was nice to see it again after all these years.
Linda, as the music plays, go ahead.
As the music plays, I would watch We Live in Public, a documentary by Andy Timiner that came out in 2009.
We Live in Public.
Yes.
Where can we find it?
I'm sure it's streaming somewhere, but it's about all these artists choosing to live in a space with all these surveillance cameras all around, about 100 people coming and going.
Well, it turns out we all live in public. That's kind of a... Not all of us. What a conversation. What a great way to close the week. Thank you, Linda Maroney. Great having you back here.
Oh, it's always good. Thank you.
Love talking to you. Matt Pasentino, a film critic for City Magazine. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I wish I got more Linda, more Matt, and more Todd in my life. Todd, you can find Dr. Sedano as a professor of television history, writing, and production at St. John Fisher University. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
From the whole team of Connections, thank you for listening. Hope you have some privacy this weekend, and we'll be back with you next week.